When it comes to economic statistics, we have been found to often be in the dark. And of course, what policymakers need more urgently than ever is the signposts that they can navigate. But this has been a fog, and the ability to do things in the old way has proved to be deeply problematic.
Welcome to this IMF podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. COVID-19 has shown the important role of data and statistics when it comes to assessing disruptions caused by the pandemic, economic and otherwise, and implementing measures to soften the blow. The Statistics Department at the IMF brings together leading thinkers in the world of data in its annual statistical forum. This year, Oxford University's Ian Golden was invited to give a keynote speech on economics, institutions, and multilateralism in the context of COVID-19, and to discuss his book, The Butterfly Defect, with IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva. Golden is the Oxford University Professor of Globalization and Development and Director of the Oxford Martin Program on Technological and Economic Change. We'll hear an excerpt of his speech, which you can hear in its entirety at imf.org, then go straight into his discussion with Kristalina Georgieva.
I worry about the expression bouncing back or reset. Because bouncing back implies that we go back onto the same tracks we were before. And reset similarly could imply that we restart the operating system that we had before, when what we need is something different. It's that business as usual. It's that way of approaching our national economies, our societies, and the global community that has got us into the crisis that we're in. And if we don't set ourselves on a different path, we inevitably are heading towards future disasters, which could be even worse than this, a pandemic which is worse, but catastrophic climate change and the intersection of forces which one can only describe as leading to a dystopian world. And so this inflection point, this moment in history, creates an opportunity. It creates an opportunity to start afresh and to reconsider things in a rather fundamental way. And already taboos that would have been regarded as impossible in January of this year have become the orthodoxy. And we see that so clearly, not least in the policies and the practices of the IMF, which has so admirably been able to say, we will do things differently because the circumstances are different. The time demands this of us, and we will rise to this occasion.
Thank you, Ian, and many, many questions. But let me start first by recognizing a very important point you made about the deficiency of a phrase now frequently used, building back or resetting. I have been out talking about building forward exactly for the same reason you have discomfort. Where we are coming from wasn't so great. We had lots of problems. And there is a massive need of transformation towards a sustainable and inclusive economy and society. And the pandemic may help us to get there if we take on board the main lesson from it. We are in this together. We can only get to a better place together. I want to start with the question about your book, The Butterfly Defect, and how globalization creates systemic risks, because you actually predicted that a pandemic could be a major obstacle to globalization. And in fact, the pandemic indeed interrupted dramatically global value chains, our interdependence, and not only brought down our economy, but even more so, it restricted trade. For this year, we predict global growth to be minus 4.4%, and it looks like it would be just about three times as much the shrinkage in trade. So my question is, how did you come with the term butterfly defect? And how is this relevant for us to build forward, to come through this crisis stronger and more resilient?
Well, thank you very much. And I'm glad we share the concern about bouncing back and the dangers inherent in going back to the tracks we were on, which would be disastrous. The butterfly defect really came out of the financial crisis. I was very aware, and I'd felt a financial crisis was coming too, that I felt the measures being undertaken to address it were fighting the past battles, not the future ones. I thought some of the measures that were adopted, for example, to break up banks because they're too big to fail, were wrong and failed to understand concentration risk. So a Hurricane Sandy or a 9/11 attack in Wall Street, if it had been a bit different, could have created a global financial crisis. And none of that was addressed in the resilience measures being implemented following the financial crisis. It was all about trying to stop the sorts of things that had led to the financial crisis happening again. And having been working on globalization for a long time and also interested in, you know, my first degree was in physics and maths, interested in complexity theory and ideas around that, I became increasingly convinced that it was this hyper-integration, this connectivity, which was not fully understood, and what you do about the nodes and networks in systems and our increasing dependence on these nodes and networks. The butterfly effect is a term that was coined by Lorentz, the famous physicist, to describe the phenomena that when a butterfly flaps its wings over the Amazon in Brazil, it could cause a tornado in Texas. This integration of systems and their unintended consequences. And obviously defect is just a play on that, because I think this is a problem, a defect of globalization that is not properly appreciated. Now, it has many, many manifestations, and it's basically about how do you manage complex interdependent systems. And that's what globalization has created. I'm a fierce advocate of globalization. I believe it's the most progressive force in the history of humanity, bringing more to jobs, more ideas, more opportunities to more people more quickly than anything in history, which is why we've seen this radical poverty reduction over the last 30 years, improvements in life expectancy, etc. But it's also the most dangerous force in human history, because this interdependence, and by globalization I mean flows across national borders of people, of ideas, digital trade, goods, manufacturers, goods and bads, this interdependence also leads to a growing potential of destabilizing, and that's risks. And that's exactly what we see now. It's inevitable. Pandemics were inevitable. Any pandemic expert would have told you that. We've been extremely lucky to escape them. We've had major pandemics in the first half of this century. SARS, MERS, yep. Avian influenza, Ebola. We got complacent. And just like I believe in finance, we've got complacent about the source of the next crisis. We've got complacent about pandemics. So it really is a need to understand the great risks we face come from this interdependence. They also come from the spillovers of the successes. Climate change is not because of the interdependence in the same way that pandemics, but it's a spillover of our success in the same way that antimicrobial resistance, for example, is a spillover. And that also requires management. Globalization is only as good as it's managed. The airport hubs are wonderful things, but we need to manage what comes through them, like cyber hubs, like financial hubs, etc. And that's really what the book's about, is why this is an issue and what we should do about it.
You very strongly advocate for coordinated action to deal with this butterfly defect. From the perspective of what we have been living through with this crisis, from the perspective of previous crises, what would you prioritize in this coordinated action? What do we need to do first to deal with the butterfly defect of globalization?
Well, I think the first thing to emphasize is that not all problems require global solutions. There are many issues, and we're seeing it now with vaccine distribution, where it's not necessarily a global institution, but a public-private partnership, the coming together of different actors that can do it. And indeed, with climate change, you know, New York State emits more carbon than most of sub-Saharan Africa, except for Nigeria and South Africa. So key countries in most challenges account for most of the problem and most of the solution. And that's certainly the case in finance, it's certainly the case in cyber, and certainly the case in climate. Pandemics are unique. And so I think what we need to do is to go through a hierarchy of the great threats we face as a first priority. And pandemic is the biggest and most dangerous threat. Then there's the danger of nuclear Armageddon and a nuclear war. There's obviously climate change and a couple of existential threats. And then you go into the threats around antimicrobial resistance, financial crisis, and you say, okay, that's the threat. We all recognize that's a threat. We might not put it in exactly the same place, but when you look at the intelligence agencies, those that are prepared to make it public ranking, they're pretty similar in terms of what the threats facing our countries are. And pandemics are way bigger than military threats, maybe 1,000 times greater for most countries. Canada, for example, makes its threats available, and you see that for Canada. And yet, then you ask the second question, okay, if that's the threat, what are we doing about it? And what you see is this total mismatch between the time, the effort, the political will, and the resources devoted to managing the threat. So, you know, let's say that most people recognize that a pandemic is 1,000 times more likely to kill us than a military attack. And yet we divide, we allocate, which will be 20,000 times more resource and energy to military than to pandemics. This disconnect between what the threat is and what we're doing about it. We have a NATO for military, and we're not giving the WHO the cost of one warship a budget. You know, one big hospital in the US or the US Coast Guard has a bigger budget than the WHO. So it's that proportionality. Then I think the question is, can one actually do it? Can you stop pandemics? And there I think you really rely on expert surveillance systems, coordination systems, and those countries with the capacity to be able to allocate. And the same is true in many others. The pandemic is a unique threat in that it can come from anywhere in the world. The poorest country, the poorest place on earth, you know, the meat market in the poorest country, or it could come from a lab in New York. And increasingly, the balance is moving towards artificial, synthetically made pandemics in terms of the risks, and crazy people with drones and things distributing them. So increasingly, the risk is actually towards the rich countries with the most labs where the threat is. So this requires everyone. But most other threats require constellations of actors. If you had 20% of the actors, they could solve 80% of the problem and develop widening circles of coherence. That's why I believe we shouldn't allow the failure of some countries to come to the table as an excuse to not act. I think the rest of the world can get on with it. And even within those countries, states, cities, companies can be a big part of the solution.
Before the pandemic, we had already, you spoke about it, unexplainable low productivity. I remember Ian starting as managing director October last year and giving my first speech on synchronized slowdown. That was what we were most worried about at that time. Inequality growing since the global financial crisis in particular, almost everywhere, a looming climate crisis. So we do face significant challenges. And on top of it, we are now living through a pandemic that is going to have long-lasting impacts unless we act. What do you see being paramount in terms of building a kind of commonality of objectives, building a vision for post-pandemic where we actually do address some of these fundamental challenges that we have been facing. I, for one, am particularly worried about slipping into expanding inequalities, landing in a place that is like Dickens's Tale of Two Cities, in which one part of the economy, the tech part, the digital part, does really well and people are better off accelerating transformation because of the pandemic, and another part of the economy falling behind or falling off the cliff altogether. And then, of course, we have the climate crisis. How would you describe a better world from where we are coming now?
Well, for me, a better world is a world which is more inclusive and sustainable, where one's life chances are not defined by who one's parents are or where one's born, where everyone has equal opportunity. And that is absolutely possible, and we've seen it happen so many places in our lifetimes. It's the success of globalization, by which I mean the spread of ideas and technologies and investment, that's created that possibility around the world. And the real question now is, do we stop that? Do we basically say, okay, those that are rich will stay rich and those that are poor are going to get poorer? Now, that will be politically toxic and unsustainable. What we saw after the 2008 crisis, of course, was that the places in Southern Europe particularly where we got very high levels of unemployment became very, very populist and extremist. In Italy, in Spain, and elsewhere, the places that were more stable, that had managed themselves more effectively through the crisis, began to support more values-based economies, as we see in Northern Europe. The Green Party, for example, does much better in Northern Europe and is non-existent in Southern Europe because people are worried about their daily living, about getting a job, and are prepared to support those that argue that they'll bring those things. I don't believe that we would have seen Brexit in the UK or indeed President Trump in the White House if it had not been for the financial crisis. These catastrophic events lead people to lose their jobs, to lose faith in the establishments, and to become very angry with the status quo. And it's not surprising, I would be too if I was in their situation. I'm not sure I would have voted the same way, but you can see where the anger comes from. And it's that failure to create an inclusive society, a cohesive society, that leads to these increasingly polarized societies like we see in the US, like we see across Europe. And although this was meant to be the great leveler, it's been the great splinterer of societies in many respects. So what your question is the right question, not least for a CEO or managing directors, what to do. And in my view, the answer is going to have to come from pretty strong different measures. So, you know, I think we have to be in a world where we're thinking about higher taxation. Extraordinary statistic I heard, the IMF can always test its statistics, but that if Jeff Bezos had given a bonus of $100,000 to every worker in Amazon, he would still be richer after the pandemic than before the pandemic. If there was a 5% wealth tax on the tech billionaires, they would still be richer after the pandemic than before the pandemic. So I think we have to be thinking about redistributive taxes. We have to be thinking about inheritance taxes. We have to be, as you are doing with your colleagues in the IMF, thinking very deeply about where growth is going to come from, where jobs are going to come from, and particularly that will manage both the challenge of the climate transition, which we have to get to net zero by at least 2050 and hopefully before, but also creating sustainable jobs. And your colleagues are doing fantastic work under your leadership on this. But it's now a time of taking this to heart. In the UK, we see a very worrying tendency, I believe, at a time when it's never been more needed. There's a discussion now of cutting the aid budget. Now, already, of course, because aid is a share of GNI, 0.7 this year is going to be in many countries 10 or 20% less than it was last year. And in the UK, they're talking about going down to 0.5. Today, the Prime Minister announced 16.5 billion new pounds for the military. Now, these are the choices that will shape the way that societies go forward, and not only domestically, whether we're able to overcome our divisions internally, but also globally. If we are to say to the countries of Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and elsewhere, that we can create a sustainable world by working together, we need to demonstrate solidarity. So my own view is that we are likely to see this. Now, a key question, which I think is particularly pertinent to the next administration in the US and also to Europe, is how does one work together with people you don't agree with? And my own view is we have to, we don't have a choice. There's no global problem that cannot, that will be solved without China, Europe, and the US working together. And so an absolute bottom line of solving global problems has to be that we might not agree on some things you do and some of your actions, but we will work together because we respect our mutual ability to solve the problem. And it's that go to fix the problem attitude which has to apply to the management of the butterfly defect.
Fantastic to be with you, and I want to thank you most sincerely for your contribution.
Thank you very, very much.
Ian Golden is the founding director of the Oxford Martin School and professor of globalization and development at Oxford University. He was speaking with IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva during the IMF's annual statistical forum. You can hear his speech on economics, institutions, and multilateralism in its entirety at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. And please subscribe if you like what you're hearing. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.